This is the Genuine Humans podcast, brought to you by Social Element. I'm Tamara Littleton.
And I'm Wendy Christie.
In our podcast, we'll discover the stories of the leaders behind the brands and the trailblazers who are making a real difference in our industry. We'll delve into how they got to where they are today.
And we'll hear about the genuine humans who supported and influenced them along the way.
Back to Genuine Humans. I'm here with my co-host, Wendy Christie. Wendy, how are you doing?
Hello. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. And I'm also a little bit overexcited because we're joined today by Crawford Hollingworth, who many of you will know. Crawford is a behavioural change expert and global chairman and co-founder of the Behavioural Architects. And he has also written How Your Brain is Wired with Kathy Tomlinson, which should be on everyone's reading list. And I'm now holding it up in front of the camera and loving it. Welcome to the podcast, Crawford.
It's very lovely to be here tomorrow, and Wendy.
Thank you. Crawford, I want to know more about what led you to writing your book with Kathy, but I also want to take you back in time. I'd like to understand, where did your career start and why the interest in behavioural science? Can you kind of like start from the early days and take us through your journey?
Yes, I can try and do that. I'm getting so old, I forget too much. But my journey began quite a long time ago. But I guess I think that the early part of my life was what probably guided where I am now today. So I guess in a nutshell, my first 20 years were complicated years. And I guess that's kind of relevant to, I think, my journey and my discovery of kind of who I was. In fact, when you were talking to me the other day, I looked back at a school report from the third school that I was expelled from. And I thought it was interesting that they summarized me as a high IQ, low performing, dysfunctional person.
Wow.
And I rather thought that was an interesting summary because my mother also said she was quite proud of what I'd achieved there. So I thought that was quite interesting. So I think I had quite a chaotic, complicated childhood, which sort of, I think, it meant I was meant to go to medical school like my parents, who are very high performing doctors, and kind of didn't, and ran off to New York at the age of 18. I don't know why New York. I had no reason to go to New York. It just seemed to be a long way away. And I guess that I began to kind of discover myself a bit there. I had a very crazy, mad time, even being on the number one rated soap opera in America for a number of months.
Wait, what?
I know. Crazy shit. But I began to, I think something weird happened. I think my brain... I had a very bad brain injury when I was four. And I think my brain maybe developed a bit more, but I suddenly became kind of really interested in human behavior. And I'm like in my 20s or 19. And then it kind of led to a period of lots of psychology. No, and I'm not just talking therapy here tomorrow. I did lots of psychology and therapy. But it was doing degrees, applied social psychology, applied behavioral psychology, and led me into my kind of first intervention in terms of behavior and behavioral change, which was sort of working in family therapy, working with alongside Bernardo's and developing projective techniques to try to understand dysfunction in family units. Absolutely loved it, absolutely fascinating. Particularly when you're a dysfunctional, high IQ, dysfunctional, low performer. Which I think I will have a T-shirt made for that now, I realise. I think I looked at my report for a long time. And I kind of guess I kind of was interested in that world, could become an academic. And suddenly, actually, I probably couldn't have become an academic, but I probably flattering myself. I suddenly met quite an interesting gentleman called Paul Feldwick and ended up having this weird day at an agency called Bose Massimi Pollock, BMP, and the home of planning. And suddenly I found myself becoming a planner at what turned out to be, I didn't realize, the most extraordinary creative agency in the world at the time. And also, I guess, the sense of 80s madness. Well, unfortunately, I think I might have developed a nickname called Bollinger, but we won't go into that today. And then a few other agencies, as you do, you triple through a few. I was Abbott Mead. I was part of the Shite Day startup in London, you know, Bates Dorland globally. And then this thing that happens to me quite a lot in my life, which is, I think, a really, again, one of those things I thought about learnings for people. I think it's really good to sometimes change everything. And even though it feels very scary, it's very easy to do the same. And all through my life, I've sort of got a little bit like, oh, I get a bit bored quite quickly. It's not a necessarily good characteristic. And I got a bit bored. I was that sort of 29-year-old, I'm sorry, 1980s stereotype. I'm a 29-year-old director of an ad agency driving a 911. Shoot me now. But it's that kind of world what it was. And I decided to do something different and started talking to a few people, really interesting people, a really nice guy who was running an agency called Simons Palmer, which is a very, very successful agency for anyone old enough to remember it. And it led to me creating my first company, which was, again, not so much about behavior, but it was about changing things. And it was about disruption and about doing things differently than they were being done. And that's, I guess, Tomorrow and Wendy, that's what always kind of drove me. Headlight Vision was created because the world of research was essentially looking, trying to drive into the future using your rear view mirror. And everything was retrospective. Nothing was about what was coming. It was all about analyzing what had been. And it was like, come on, this is mad. And Headlight Vision was, as it says on the tin, it was shining its headlights to create vision and to drive change. And we all set about identifying the kind of behavioral energies, the energies that shape you and me and help clients connect to the energies which are really changing the world we live in, the crazy, crazy fast energies in the late 80s and 90s. And suddenly I found this was just such a fascinating world. We had Faith Popcorn doing stuff in America, interesting people trying to say how the world is changing and helping you as a brand change. And all the kind of cool brands wanted to be part of this. So, I mean, I look back at it and you kind of took it for granted a bit, but people like Sony PlayStation were new and they were one of our first clients. And then Nike came. And I remember, like, you know, going to Portland and meeting these kind of crazy people and even Phil Knight and those days. And we're doing loads of interesting work for them and them sending us around the world just to watch the trends evolving. And then companies like Diageo and the big players came in. And again, what I really love about that journey and was, again, it's really fabulous to create. I'm very lucky that I've had the ability to work with very talented people. But we created the first global set of cool hunters in, I think it was like 49 cities around the world, people who were called, they were called global streetscapers. And literally, they looked at what was cool on the streets, what was happening, what were the trends. I remember, by the way, we don't, you know, phones, we don't really have phones or the computers aren't that well developed at this stage. You know, and I started writing a column in a magazine, which hopefully some of you know, called Dazed and Confused. And it was kind of really kind of cool. Photographers like Rankin was who launched it. And anyway, and yeah, it was just a really interesting time to be part of the youth movement.
How were you finding those street, was it streetscapers, did you say, these yeah. people?
I mean, sometimes it's funny because you look at what people write and you find people who are kind of cultural influencers. In the same way that you might have influence on the internet now, you find people who know their cities have got their fingers on that proverbial pulse and everything. And again, they just see things. They see emerging patterns, emerging trends. You know, you're sitting in a cafe in Japan and you see streetwear changing, shoe wear changing. Yeah, music tastes changing, bars changing. And even one of our jobs we got with Diageo was to do quarterly reports on, I think, 20 cities around the world and what are the new cool bars. It was a tough world. And then I guess I was in my mid-30s and we launched a product called Engaged, which was really cool about old people over 50s. Not so, I don't think of them as old anymore. And I think it was the only, and we really looked, we did all these trends. What are the trends shaping this new world? People don't die at 50 anymore. They live long lives. And I think that we have the honor of being the first time on the front page of the FT, the Financial Times, where an article about our work talked about the increase in sex in the over 50s. I think it was the only time the word sex had been on the front page of the FT. which is very cool. And we did lots of kind of crazy interviews. And then a much bigger product, which became, and still is a product that exists, called Global Behavioral Energies. And it also is quantitative. And it looked at those big energies, like your relationship with space, time, people, changing. And it looked how brands, the kind of hooks that comes out of those energies, and how brands can harness those hooks to energize their change and propel them into the future. And it was really, really fascinating times. We grew really quickly in New York and London, where we launched it. Never that big, but we became quite quickly interested by the classic, you know, Interpublics, Omnicoms, WPPs, and sold to WPP after only 4 years or 4.5 years.
Wow. Yeah.
And then had a lovely time there, did some really cool stuff again, trying to help clients look into the future and harness the future. And we merged with the Henley Center. That was one of the things we did after a few years. And then we bought an agency called Yankolevich, which is a super cool trend agency in America. Realized that Headlight Vision, Henley Center, Yankolevich was okay if you're an ad agency, but not so good if you're a brand. So it became the Futures Company, which you guys will probably also know. And then we became part of Kantar and not part of WPP. And I guess the journey then for me was someone who, like, wow, that was some roller coaster ride. I've loved all the change, the disruption, things we've helped brands literally pioneer new things, new brands, new spaces. And then it all got a little bit like doing the same thing. And weird stuff happens. And so I'm Wendy. When you've been in the world a long time, things get a bit stale, and my head gets a bit stale. And there was kind of like a perfect storm brewing, which was unknowing to me, was taking me back to my kind of early days, which was that one of the things happening was everyone was getting bored with attitudinal change. So we were changing attitudes all the time, and more behavior wasn't following. This kind of, I don't know, intention-action gap was getting wider and wider and wider. And clients getting more frustrated, going like, well, we've changed the attitudes, but nothing's happening. Behavior's not following. And at that same time, there was lots of, this was about 14 years ago, there was lots of really interesting thinking coming out of MIT, coming out of Harvard, about behavioral psychology, about behavioral science, about behavioral economics. And wow, suddenly it was like there was this new sweet shop opening that says, actually, forget attitudes. You know that behavior that we've all ignored because we don't really understand it? We can actually now begin to define the blueprint of behavior. We can actually begin to say, like, wow, what is it that is actually causing someone to do something or not do something? We can begin to almost map the brain at the same time where, you know, the kind of genome was unraveling, the double helix, we were learning more about genetics. The brain was suddenly becoming a scientific thing that we're, versus a clever theory, it was real knowledge about how it is structured. And if you understand the structure of something that leads to behavior, it is incredibly empowering to then look at how to change it. Now, I guess you know this history a little bit. I guess there's a bit of a dark patch comes in my life then. with lots of things I've done, there has been good patches and bad patches. Classic British understatement. But my current company wasn't so excited about what we were thinking of doing. And me and my fellow founders, Sean Davies and Sarah Davies, spent about 2 years on unpaid gardening leave, as you do. But anyway, the Behavioral Architects was born, and it had a really simple mission and still has a kind of that mission, which is to bring the new behavioral science, this new understanding of your brain, my brain, to show how these frameworks, these concepts, you know, can help anyone understand behavior. And if you understand why someone's doing something, you are really empowered by that blueprint to know how to change it. And even work we do these days in Google, decoding decisions in the messy middle, it's all the same. Understand why someone's doing something, and that empowers you to then use these amazing concepts to nudge and steer it in different directions. And to be honest, we've had one hell of a ball. I mean, it's been a tough 12 years. You know, I'm not going to get political in America, get political here, talk about COVID. It's been a bit mad. But we have been so blessed by, inspirational clients who, and governments and people who want to do things different and want to grasp new understanding to create real change in the world, real change in their brands, real change in direction, working with Diageo's, Mondelez, Google's, Amazon's, IKEA's, Disney's. I mean, you know, I could name 50, 60 clients who have been extraordinary in supporting our 12 years in Shanghai, you know, Sydney, Melbourne, London, and a little bit in New York. And I guess that still kind of takes me in a very quick way to where I am or where I was 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And COVID hit. And Kathy and me, who's always worked really closely with me in behavioral science, just sat going, behavioral science has changed our lives. Mm. It's changed how, oh God, my daughter will kill you, but but I remember my daughter once was dancing on the table in a mad, crazy way when she was much younger. And I got angry thinking she's going to fall off the table. But that's my reaction was anger, wrongly anger. And Kathy looked at my daughter and went, wow, hasn't she become independent?
And I, very different take.
Yeah. And I looked at it and I thought, it's just a reframe. And I realized, we realized all our lives have changed. It's, you know, whether we're putting notes outside that, you know, play on social norms so our fellow residents recycle or whatever it is, we realized it had changed our lives. And the book that you kindly showed earlier was us writing a book, not for all the businesses we work with around the world or the governments, but just for normal people. And it was, yeah, it was always had a simple mantra, which is the more you understand how your brain is wired, the more the little things you can do, tiny little changes make a big difference, hence that reframing. If you're fed up with someone, then even if you think maybe they're having a bad day, you feel better about it. You know, if you do something nice to someone, a bit of reciprocity, you actually start like a flutter of butterfly wings. You don't know where that will go, but you're probably making the world a better place somewhere else. And the book takes you on a journey of understanding your brain, how people are playing to that understanding. And then all Kathy's work at the end is looking at how teaching people about the brain made them change their lives and hundreds of little ideas. In fact, I would challenge anyone, and I really mean that. I'll give their money back if it doesn't. Buy the book. You don't have to buy the book, but buy the book. And if it doesn't change your behavior in some way, I would be amazed. Little things. And even if it's remembering to get off the hedonic treadmill occasionally, you'll find it inspiring.
And something that I've really taken away from the book is that whole concept of not being stuck in autopilot, that all of the good stuff happens when you do, you know, take yourself out of that comfort zone. And just hearing about your career and where there were times where you just sort of like suddenly changed direction, I wonder if that's a bit of a theme for you, that you are always kind of, you know, you talk about disruption, but you've been taking yourself out of that comfort zone and going in a different direction as well.
I think probably people would say for the good and for the worst that I have done that. You know, there are times when, you know, I probably should have been more stable. But, you know, if you ask Kathy about the person doing really well in advertising who comes home and says, I've had enough, I'm leaving, just as she's become pregnant, never goes down that well. You know, or the person who moves the family to Oxford and the next week launches a business in London and New York. But I do think, again, one of the things I think is really important is if you are lucky enough to be brave and to find ways to challenge things, to create things that aren't really there. I mean, there wasn't a behavioral science consultancy. The BIT was beginning to start place. There wasn't any company doing soft behavioral trends that Headlight Vision did. And lots of other stuff I've done which failed miserably. But it's fabulous to try and break existing paradigms, to break the status quo. It's so often you will find, you know, people spend their lives making something a little bit better, or you know, or working with all the same rules that have always been there. You know, I mean, I know people have to do that, but it's very frustrating, I think, as well.
Thank you for sharing that journey with us, Crawford. You've touched upon a couple of things, actually, that I'd love to talk about. So you mentioned your school report and also your brain injury at 4 years old. And what I wanted to talk about is what you were like as a child and how much that kind of thing has impacted where you are now.
Whoa. What did my therapist say? Don't let anyone ask you about what you were like as a child. It unlocks too many things. It's a very interesting question, actually. And I think my childhood, I was a bit lost. I think I wasn't necessarily, I was a kind of blue-eyed blonde kid. I think I was a bit difficult, a bit of a pain in the arse, very restless. I don't know what was going on. I was very inquisitive about things. And I was very interested in people, I think, from an early age. Yeah, I think in quite a clinical way versus what I am now, which is in a much deeper way. My parents were really pioneering doctors. So my dad was a very complicated and difficult psychiatrist who actually ultimately decided he didn't really want his family anymore. But was very important in a hospital called the Maudsley and was decorated globally many times for his work on families, which is also rather ironic. They were both doing really, really well. And my mum was a powerful doctor wanting to change life in a quiet way for women and for medicine. And, you know, she became things like from John Lewis, director of occupational medicine, medical director of the BBC, to, the occupational medical head of the Royal Marsden, where she got cancer, sadly, although she always pointed out it wasn't infectious. And she'd always laugh about that. So I think my childhood was a bit kind of mad, a bit sort of crazy. I think, if I'm honest with you, I think for about 4 years of my very key childhood between 13 and 17, I didn't actually have a home because my parents were divorced, they were seeing other people, there was madness, and they were living in different places. I probably shouldn't say too much here, actually, Wendy, because the brain thing has become quite a big topic in the last few months in my life, having something that no one's ever discussed before in my life. My sister brought this up at Christmas as a reason why I was always the loved one and she had a really tough time as the child. She was always the one getting A stars. I was always the one being expelled. And she said, yes, because no one talks about your brain injury. And no one's ever said that before. Your brain damage, she said. No one's ever said that in front of my kids and other kids. Everyone's going to say, whoa, let's just go back a moment. And we're still getting our heads around that. So we were told never to mention it. But I said, I knew I'd fractured my skull badly and everything. But she said, you had brain damage. We all had to pretend you didn't. So, and unfortunately, my mum died a few years ago. And so I can't really ask her about it. So I'm a bit like, whoa. So we're living with that at the moment. But I think I know they tested me. So I did have a high IQ. I was rubbish at everything, Wendy. I mean, I failed everything. I had U's and E's. I was just rubbish at everything. And I guess in those days, people didn't know about things like dyslexia. But then I was really, really good at hand and ball games. I was really good at sport. And I was really good at chess. And I had this kind of weird thing where I'd win stupid chess competitions, which kind of bored me, but I found them very easy to do. And I played sport pretty well, at least at a county level anyway. In various things. But I was rubbish at the rest, making my schools and my parents' life quite difficult, which is why I said at the beginning, I think something happened when I got into 20 and the rest of my brain developed really well. And my mum has always been my soulmate, and still is actually, and never, ever lost faith in me, ever, 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 ever. Never questioned any stupid thing I did. And believe me, there were many of them.
And here you are. So thinking about the people that you've worked with over the years, which genuine humans have really influenced you or in your life in general? It doesn't have to be in work.
I guess I'm going to have to go back to what I've just said a little bit, being repetitive. But I think the environments, in terms of when you talk about influence or context, it's such an important thing, because in a world where we need to make lots of changes and there are brilliant people trying to make changes, you need to feel that there is support behind you. And I've never felt I've had to look back. I've always known that I've got support, and that is when you're a bit crazy, it's so beautiful. And so again, I would probably say, oh, you know, my mum again. I mean, my mum, as I said, she was in such a quiet way, she made a difference. She hated fuss. You know, when they did a thing for her in the City of London, they remembered her. All these people came out and said, you know, how my mum changed their world. You know, whether it's creating the first ever secondary cancer care, or, you know, or getting another board position for women where women had no board positions. It was stuff that really mattered to her. And she never questioned, you know, your sons get sent home again. Your son's expelled again. You're called into another thing. Your son's failed in something. Your son's done this. We found your son in a shop doing things he shouldn't do, you know, and it was just like, oh, well. And when she was made president of Occupational Medicine Europe, the first ever woman to hold the title, I was in the audience and she said she was so proud. And she said, I am generally proud that my son has been expelled from some of the best schools in this country.
Oh, what a legend.
And she was a legend. And I think she, every time, and she loved what I did. She loved that it was different. And after we talked about, you know, therapies in cancer, and we talked about trends, we talked about the world. And, you know, she was generally fascinated by things I was doing. She's like, really, no one does this. And this is really exciting space. But I guess it'd be wrong if I didn't also mention Kathy, who has been my partner, my wife for many years. And has always been my intellectual, well, she's always been just my intellectual, let's be honest. and often helping me with some of my emotion, which is a bit heavy. And yeah, she just has always made things happen. And when you live in a world where you constantly, whenever you're doing well, you throw it all away. And she could tell you lots of examples. And she'd say, wow, well, we learned a lot from it. And it was brilliant. What are we doing next? And it was never questioned, you know. And I think, again, if we all need to think really carefully when we want to do things differently, we need to have those people which, you know, it's a cliche, but not only would they catch me if I fell, but my mum and Kathy, but they'd also go like, God, yeah, that is really exciting. Let's do that. Maybe they might turn their heads and go, oh, God, he's got another idea. Here he goes. But they'd always support it. And I think, you know, again, I always say to people when I try and mentor people who are trying to do interesting new things is create a context around you that gives you permission, that gives you support, that you know will help you make things happen. And I've been very lucky, very, very lucky to be gifted the sort of people who've been around me in work and my family and things like that.
And actually, if I could just sort of dig into that a little bit more, because I know that, Crawford, you and I have had sort of conversations about getting to a stage of our life where we can be more vulnerable and open with the people around us. And it's also about finding, obviously, you've got Kathy, you've got these incredible people around you, but also the networks around us, the sort of the special tribes, as it were. Are you happy to talk about perhaps some of the impact that some of those people have had on you?
You know me, Tamara. Vulnerability is a very big part of me. I would try not to start crying at any point in this, but it'd be quite likely. You know, I wear my heart on the outside. I've always had I've always used that thing. It's in my hand. I get hurt a lot. And always have, because when you put yourself out there, I'm not joking, you get really, really hurt, but you also get fantastic ups. And I think to make the point first is I'd never swap a life of emotional highs and deep, dark lows for black blandness. Yeah. You know, and I think the context we just talked about supports that. And, you know, I love people like yourself, people who have passion and belief. I find it infectious and I can't get enough of it. And I love it. I love it. I love it. And I think if I can unlock that in people around me, then I'm leaving something on the world. It's a great thing to try and do. And so you need to have people around you. You need to have groups of people who you know you can be yourself in, you can be vulnerable with, your place to be. And I guess I have a few tiny places, but there is a place which you know well, a place where I feel I can be a unique place, which is both professional and personal and everything, a place where I can be open, a place where I don't need to be hesitant, a place where I can be brave, a place where I feel secure, a place where I trust everyone. And all those really powerful emotions, they're easy to say and very hard to find. And for me, the great representation is a thing called the Cabal. It sounds like a strange name, but it was set up by two extraordinary people, Gemma and Dan. I mean, with sparing their blushes, radiate nurture, love and openness, and create environments where you just grow. You just grow and you are yourself and you don't have to have any pretense. And you can burst into tears. You can be vulnerable. You can be excited, whatever it wants. And it's a beautiful place where you can have all those things, a place which will 100% catch you if you need catching, or 100% help you propel yourself in a direction if you need propelling. And so I guess I love and I really support non kind of judgmental places of warmth and nurture, and also places with a hell of a lot of love. Because again, I think that creates a beautiful functioning system and makes people like me, the high IQ, dysfunctional, low performer, feel very good and very able to do things. Exactly.
I'd also like to pick up on something else. You were talking about your dyslexia. And this is something that I was really taken with when you've spoken before about seeing the world in patterns. How has that actually impacted? Because it sounded a negative experience growing up. Has it become more positive for you in your career?
Yeah, so it's a really, really interesting question. And the answer would be yes, it has. In fact, my belief is that all of us have gifts, and only some of us are lucky enough to find out what they are. Is the kind of truth of things. And I guess I've always, I kind of stumbled on, because I was rubbish at everything else and people didn't really use the term dyslexia, but I just couldn't do stuff. You know, I still can't spell, even though I write a lot too. You know, everyone says I married Kathy because she was an English graduate to try to make that, to take that out, you know. But, I've always been interested in patterns of behavior. And I guess I began to realize that I've always loved art. I've always loved seeing things in art. And I began to realize that I could look at lots of things happening around the world and see patterns behind them. I could see, you know, and I realized it was a gift, because you realize you work with lots of people who can't. Mm. You know, and so there's whatever, 40 pieces of data, 20 imagery, and you go like, oh, I think you could put these here, put those there, combine these here, and create something really interesting. And so I guess that took me on a really interesting journey. It's why when I worked in therapy, I used the projective techniques I developed with photographs, how to use photographs, family photographs, as a family Freudian slip was the paper I wrote. And it was how that photographs, people bring photos to the therapy session and suddenly they talk openly, because the visual stimulus doesn't have the verbal barricades that you have in therapy. So I've always been interested in, I guess, nonverbal and patterns. And if you think about trends and Headlight Vision, the Futures Company, if you think about products I've created like Brainy Bite Likes, we won't go into my AI company 14 years ago, a little bit before its time.
Pioneer.
Yeah, well, just a loss maker. Or the behavioral architects. It's about looking for patterns, trying to look at understanding. I guess it's like behavior is a form of art. What are all those things driving that behavior? Mapping it out in a kind of visual way, thinking about then, what have you permission to change? What if you did this? What if you did that? And it's a very creative yet scientific and visual process. And I think I was lucky to find I was quite good at in those sort of spaces. And that's why I still, you know, I still have the ideas that I'm wrestling with at the moment are, you know, a lot of my stuff I'm working in my head is that what AI doesn't do is, to me, create jumps into creativity and insight beyond what it knows. And I'm really intrigued of how the developing symbiotic relationship between man, machine and AI could evolve.
I hope that you never stop having these amazing ideas, because I love being around you. We're now going to move into the quickfire round. So I'm going to let Wendy kickstart with the questions.
What's your idea of a perfect weekend?
Of course, you say quickfire. This one's have to really think of that now. Perfect weekend. I guess, again, it sounds really boring, but I'm definitely small groups. I'm kind of crazy deep conversations, which might go in every single weird direction. 100% great food, way, way too much red wine. Definitely tomorrow would love this. Drunken singing and dancing.
What are you saying?
And in my case, I'd say tomorrow, not in yours. In my case, with 100% enthusiasm and very little talent.
How do you think you'd fare in a zombie apocalypse?
Oh, blank. When's that happening?
We're already in it.
Yes, I know. That's just politics. So again, I really like that thought, the kind of idea of a zombie apocalypse. Now, actually, Kathy's in the other room working, but if I pulled her through, I think she'd say that annoyingly, really annoyingly, she'd say Crawford would make friends with them. he'd lean into them and try to understand and explore their journey into zombiness. And as I'm lucky, 70% of communication is nonverbal. We'd probably have a frenzy of body activity analysis, which would be a perfect place for behavioral psychologists. Maybe behavioral psychologist heaven. Me sitting with the zombies doing a group discussion about how they got there.
I'm now picturing a whole kind of like therapy room with that. Okay, what's the last thing you did that gave you childlike joy?
Do you know, I think, again, it's a really hard question for me, because I think I am still a child, and I get so much joy every day. Things make me kind of smile and laugh and feel fantastic. I guess, I mean, I'm very lucky. 2 days ago, you know, I happened to find myself at 5:30 a.m. sitting in St. Peter's Square without anyone being in the square, and the sun came over the top. And I found myself giggling. It was like, you know, it's like, show me a sign, any sign, and the sun came
That's
over.
Perfect.
And it was very beautiful. But I am very lucky tomorrow. I do have a problem that I am very childlike, and I find a lot of joy in the tiniest little things all the time.
I don't think you need to apologise for that.
How would your friends describe you?
They're really interesting questions, aren't they? How my friends describe me? Well, definitely my very close friends would describe me as an annoying bundle of energy. Always with the word annoying. And in fact, my best friend would say so annoying. And that I get up way, way too early all the time. And they've always said the only reason you're successful is you end up, every time you have to do more, you just get up early until you basically don't go to bed. But I also hope they describe me as someone who really treasures and really actively guards those in my, I'm going to get into the film now, in my inner circle of trust. And I really try to do that. And I think it's that, actually, it makes me think, Wendy, a little bit. It's like, it's that circle of trust with my, you know, I keep my friends really close. I'm not using the cliche, because they're really important. And I think it's the certainty, maybe, the structure, the constancy of them, that helps me take crazy risks, be a bit braver, maybe challenge the status quo, be disruptive in some way. Well, I hope so anyway.
Is there one person who's changed your life, but they don't know it?
I think, as I am as a human, is that nearly every one of you changes my life. And I sometimes think I'm greedy like that I get so much from everybody, whether it's, you know, talking to someone about their new business plan, talking to someone about their new company, and talking to someone about their karaoke in Ibiza. Gives me something. It energizes me. It makes a difference. So everybody who touches my life actually has a really big impact. I was going to think, I suddenly thought about someone, I thought I better not mention his name because he's quite well known. But I think the reason that I eventually first left advertising was a new CEO who basically, I just didn't like him. So in a weird way, he thought he had ruined my life, because I just didn't want to work with him anymore. But in fact, he started my new life.
I think that's brilliant. It's been such a joy to have you. I knew this was going to be a fascinating conversation. I just knew it. And I'm so delighted that we've been able to talk to you. Is there anything that we've missed? Anything that you wish we'd asked? Or do you have any closing thoughts? I'm going to pass the last bit to you.
Well, first of all, Tamara, you did tell me that you might ask me a question about music, which is the only thing I thought about.
I left that out. I just caught, because you were just saying about that you weren't like the big fan of karaoke. My last one was, of course, what is your karaoke go-to song, which you can answer.
It was the only thing I was thinking about. So I thought, Tamara did say something about a karaoke song. So it's one which you might have even seen me sing, which is Wonderwall.
Oh, I love Wonderwall.
And singing it with my kids, and the words resonating again a bit about my life, because, oh my God, this is terrible. I feel I'm going to say it now, because, you know, we all know, don't we, Tamara, that all the roads are winding and all the lights are blinding. And even that line, there are many things that I'd like to say to you, but I don't know how, again, is kind of really core to it. And I talked to my daughter and she asked me about it. She asked, I'm doing this really interesting talk with someone I really like, and someone I really like as well, Wendy. I've only met you, but and she said, what about the one that we used to love when you used to hate the world? I said, what was it? She said, when you get angry with things because they're not changing, or you're looking at people who are misogynistic, blah blah blah, things that really annoy me. She said, she said, what is it? She said, you know, we've sang it together, and we started singing it, which was Lily Allen, which was Excuses.
Oh, brilliant.
Fuck you very, very much. And I think, again, it's like, fuck all the drains out there, get them out of our lives and stuff.
Brilliant.
So I guess it's interesting you asked me that thing about something you haven't asked. I guess I'm going to ask you both a question, because I love talking to you, and I love thinking about things. So you don't think about your past life, you just look into the future, which is the exciting thing. But thinking back made me very reflective. But trying to tell you a journey that I've been on and my life, there's only really a point to it if it creates a little seed of energy or thought in you that changes your lives. In some way, even if it's a tiny, tiny thing. So I'd love to hear from both of you if there's anything I have said in the last hour that has made you go, wow, I need to think about that a bit more, something that has left a thought in your life that might grow into something bigger.
That's a really good question. I think I have vibed off your passion, as I always do, to do with the energy that you bring. I think for me, I'm aware that I don't put enough time aside to sit down in a cafe and read and just kind of like just take in information. I take in lots of information from different places, but I think your love of the world, and I kind of want to go back to, I mean, I studied psychology as well, and everything that you were talking about reminded me of why I love it, and I haven't gone back there enough. So, and in fact, going back to your book, that's why I'm enjoying it so much, because it is taking me back to that place. And what brought me into this industry, which was, I just love people. So yes, you have inspired me.
I'm going to give you one tiny thing tomorrow. So never buy a coffee that you don't sit there and drink and watch.
Mm. Yeah.
We all grab a coffee and rush off somewhere with it. Grab your coffee and watch people. Just sit there. It's a tiny thing, and you will get such reward.
I will do that, and I'll let Wendy answer.
I was really interested in what you seem to get out of revisiting that old school report, and it's made me want to dig mine out and see if anything triggers something there. And I'm now dying to read your book.
My mum once kept a school report of mine, and she showed it to me once, and I said, "Why do you keep this one?" She said, "Because it always made me laugh." I said, "Why?" She said, "Look at it." And I went, oh, I did quite well there. Oh, a B. Oh, a C. An A. She said, yeah, but look at it again. I said, what? She says, you've written them in. You can see that they've been Tippex or whatever.
You've been listening to Genuine Humans, brought to you by Social Element. If you loved what you heard, remember to rate, review, and subscribe.